In this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast, we're joined by NYCAviation.com editor Ben Granucci. We talk about the change of CEOs at Spirit Airlines, some drone news from the 2016 Consumer Electronics Show, including the FAA's new app, the Airbus A350, plane spotting, hand-flying the airplane by commercial and GA pilots, five-engine airplanes, the odd-looking Northrop Tacit Blue, and more, all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 384 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. Thanks for introducing me first, because I'm back after a fairly long absence, or it seems like a long absence anyway.
It feels like it, yeah.
And it's really sad. I've been so busy and my life has been so crazy. You guys are now the sanity in my life.
That's a really scary thought.
Oh, but dear. It's true.
All right. Up next with us, we have the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, a glass cockpit expert. Max Trescott, how are you?
Hey, good evening. And boy, I was starting to think I should be a Dr. Max here. So tell me, Brian, what are your problems? How have you been feeling lately?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, this is only an hour, hour and a half long show. There's not enough time.
All right, so I'll have to charge my higher rate there. Yeah, I'm fine. I was off flying again this morning and had some interesting observations with a gentleman flying instruments that tie into one of our news stories here, so that'll be fun to talk about.
Oh, good. Always nice to stir that sort of thing in.
Indeed, bring real life into the news.
Speaking of stirring things in, we have with us also the one, the only, Mr. Rob Mark. He's also a pilot, flight instructor. He's also an aviation journalist and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Good evening. And Max T, I thought you promised you weren't going to tell anybody about our session today.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. No, hey, welcome from Chicago, where it's, we're operating from the Camp Jetwine patio tonight. Having a fruity drink. It's a balmy 84 here.
And, no, it's not.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay. You guys don't believe me, do you?
No, not in the least.
Okay, well, it will all come clear. It will all become clear later in the show.
Okay, that worries me. Finally, we have with us our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof, from the edge of the Philadelphia runway. Hey, David.
Yes, I'm in a no-fly zone if you're a droniac. Good evening, everyone. Looking forward to a interesting show tonight and listening to Max ramble on and on and on with Brian's interjections.
Okay. I'm glad you're really charged up for this episode, David. Well, our guest this episode is Ben Granucci. Ben's the standards editor for NYC Aviation. It's a New York City-based, globally focused aviation news, commentary, and enthusiast website. He's an avid aviation photographer and a lifelong av geek. In addition to his work with NYC Aviation, Ben also occasionally writes for airlinereporter.com. So, Ben, welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening. How is everybody?
Terrific. So, standards editor. If you had just said that you were the editor or an editor, I think I would have known what that meant. But when you say a standards editor, what do you do?
In addition to the normal preparing of our articles, along with our editing team, of which there are two other editors, I'm also working in the background on coordination and making sure that no matter who is writing and who is editing, the end product is unified and seamless.
I get it. That makes sense when you said it. So you're ensuring that the editorial standards of NYC Aviation are met. Kind of across the spectrum. All right, good.
Yes.
And how long have you been with or associated with NYC Aviation?
About 2.5 years I've been on staff.
Well, we always love folks from NYC Aviation. We've had several over the years join us as guests on the episode. It's always a great bunch. It's a great website for those of you who aren't familiar with nycaviation.com. We'll be talking about that in a lot more detail coming up. One thing I just wanted to mention real quick, over in our listener team on Slack, we had a question from Jet City Star. He asked for this week's show, he said, are you going to include a news item about the 4 centennial birthdays this year in aviation? Now, my response was, there's 4? So I'll put it to you guys. Do you guys know what the 4 centennial birthdays are in aviation this year?
So people that were born in 1916?
No. or companies, let's say, or organizations.
Huh.
Who's say 100 years old this year in 2016? Any guesses? Yeah, Rob.
I think Boeing is one of them.
That's right. Boeing is one of them.
Ding.
Ding, ding.
The United States Coast Guard?
Yes, that's number 2.
Ooh. And I know the rest of the answers, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut and let the other co-hosts work on it.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, can I use Google?
No.
Oh, darn it.
There's one that Rob should know about.
I do. And I'm not going to divulge that because I want the other people to have a chance.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll tell you. It's Dassault.
The French aircraft manufacturer.
That's right.
Is that so?
That's so. All right, and the fourth one is a publication.
Wait a minute. Airfax?
Nope.
No. Yes.
Avleak. Smithsonian Air and Space?
What's that?
No, Avleak.
Avleak. Aviation Week. 100 years old. That's
holy cow.
I know.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
I had no idea. So there's our 4 centennials from the world of aviation for this year. Interesting.
And to mark that 100th anniversary, Aviation Week just last week released all of their archives on the web, and they are a huge time sink, but full of amazing information.
Can you mention where people will find them?
Aviationweek.com, I would think.
All right, good. We'll look for that. All right, well, let's get started with some aviation news from the past week. Are you guys all ready?
Ready. Yeah. Ready from the West.
First up, we have an item from Fortune.com. The Spirit Airlines board announced that board member Robert Fornaro would replace Ben Baldanza as the CEO of the ultra-low-cost airline. Fornaro was the AirTrans CEO who managed the sale to Southwest in 2011. In the article, Fortune speculates that this change was sudden, and the choice of Fornaro was a quick one. A lot of people are kind of looking at this and trying to read the tea leaves and try to get an understanding of just exactly what's gone on here at Spirit Airlines. What do you guys think?
You don't make money, you piss off a lot of people, you can lose your job.
Very good, Brian. Short and sweet.
Our next story.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if Spirit doesn't merge with either Allegiant or Frontier or something like that. That's the section of the airline industry that has been kind of, so sorry, no pun intended, kind of winging it. Although Allegiant's been making money and Spirit's been making money and people hate them, but they love them because they're after different people. They're after people that would not even fly at all. So to them, 16 in a seat is not that big a deal.
Well, it's interesting that the airline Spirit has been profitable, although I guess it's been kind of eroding somewhat recently. But the big change is over the last 12 months, their stock price has, I think, dropped by about 50%. So profits are nice, but the declining stock price, that doesn't keep the board of directors happy, and it sure doesn't keep the shareholders happy either.
Yeah, so true.
So we actually published something on the website on Monday. Aviation analyst Zina Aziz, who is Australia-based, wrote on the synergies of such a merger. And she makes a compelling argument in favor that the two networks would complement each other quite well.
Yeah, the fleets are very compatible, right? They're flying essentially the same aircraft, right? Airbus yes. aircraft.
It's Airbus A320 family. It appears that they are different engines, but that hasn't stopped mergers in the past. Single fleet type is kind of more important.
Another issue I think she looked at in that article is concerning the networks. You know, if you combine the networks of the two, does the result make sense, or not?
And both of those airlines are using the model of flying from major city airports to vacation destinations. Allegiant, on the other hand, likes to go to outlying airports like Stewart in New York instead of the JFKs and LaGuardias and Newarks.
Yeah, the reason why I don't see a merger working, I don't think it'll happen, is the DOJ seems to be really reluctant to approve mergers. You know, look at Staples Office Depot recently. Mm. They've certainly put the brakes on that, and I think they've just seen such a consolidation of airlines recently and pricing not going down the way they think that they should have due to these consolidations. I don't know. I think that if they were planning on doing this, they should have done it 2 years ago.
On the flip side, a strong ultra low cost carrier like a Spirit Frontier tie up could spur lower fares in major markets, which is what the DOJ kind of is looking for.
So the combined airline would be called Front It?
Oh, dear. You know, we spoke with Henry Hartevelt last week as our guest, and the timing of this announcement and our recording with Henry was just off by a little bit. In fact, Henry said to us afterwards that he wished that he'd been able to comment on the show about this. But Henry's quoted in Aviation Week as saying that he thinks that Fornaro is going to focus on revenues. He says, yeah, there's that merger thing out there, but he notes, or the article notes in Aviation Week, that Spirit's increased their capacity by 30%. Yields and load factors have fallen. That's had an effect on the investor perception of the airline, and also this growth, this very strong growth, has strained operations. So Henry thinks that maybe he'll focus on revenues and kind of getting the airline onto a more solid footing. And then there's the merger coming up.
Yeah, just as long as they don't bring the rest of the airline industry down to their level and continue to charge for everything and reduce seat pitch and all the other fun stuff that Spirit and Frontier are known for.
Now, Baldanza doesn't get to just, skip away with no package. Skift has an article where they report that, while he does give up his $500,000 a year salary, that he will get $1 million in monthly payments over the next 2 years. He'll consult with the airline for 1 year, and who knows what that compensation package is. He still has rights to the 2015 performance bonus, and he gets over 30,000 shares of restricted stock. So, as is often the case with these things, the big guys on top, when they leave, even if they're tossed out, and we don't really know if that's the case here, but even then, these guys tend to have a contract that lets them leave with a nice little package, and I guess that's happened here.
The market rules.
Yeah.
He also gets to fly Spirit wherever he would like, along with his family. I'm not sure if that's a golden parachute or a giant lead weight, though.
Yeah, it could be interpreted either way. And he gets that for life. So
for life.
Yeah.
See, we're thinking that's a benefit. During the negotiations, he was screaming, "Oh, please don't give me lifetime benefits. Please, no, anything but that."
Oh, yeah.
But they gave it to him anyway.
And knowing their safety records, lifetime might not be so long.
Okay, moving on. This past week we had the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is the annual gathering of, well, all sorts of companies that have something to sell or think they will in the future that's for consumers along the technology areas. And there were some aviation-related news items coming from that. In Travel and Leisure, we see it's official, human-carrying drones are happening. Now, this comes from a China-based company, Ehang, and they just announced this Ehang 184. It's an autonomous electric drone, and they say it should be in production in a year. David, this thing looks like a giant quadcopter.
Actually, Max, it's a giant octocopter. There are rotors on top and bottom of the forearms with a cockpit in the center. You know, when this came out, everybody was rolling their eyes. And when does a drone become a helicopter? Especially if you're sitting inside of it. And my understanding was that it was going to be flown autonomously by someone remotely. And then everybody else was talking about bringing your laptop aboard and flying it from your iPhone or your laptop. One wonders where the word drone starts and the word helicopter ends. I don't know. But I'm sure that Rob is willing to volunteer for the first flight.
Oh, yeah.
But it'll be a short flight. It's only 23 minutes.
That's right. I can imagine. Max T, can you imagine sitting in the back with your own little remote going, okay, I think I got this one. Oh, you know, flaring from row 23 is not as easy as it looks.
Yeah, and you know, all the drone community was complaining when the 333 exemptions came out that said the operator had to have a pilot's license. In this case, the operator of this thing darn well better have a pilot's license if there's a person on board. I mean, this...
If they had a pilot's license and were not flying it from the vehicle... Under a 333 the problem with this is this blurs all of the lines that we are all trying to figure out what they are to begin with. It's kind of a bizarre concept. I don't know what to think about it.
I'm just saying, if there's somebody on board this thing, one of those people better have a pilot license. I mean, we can certainly argue whether people flying drones from the ground need licenses or not, and I think someday there will be a separate drone operator license, but I think you're going to need more than that to operate this if you're on board.
Well, my understanding from the Ehang website is that you basically put in the coordinates of your destination, and this thing is supposed to autonomously take you there.
Yeah, just like an Amazon package.
Yeah, or the Jetsons. I think there's a lot of issues here. I mean, it's a single passenger vehicle, as Brian mentioned, 23-minute flight time. It's got a 220-pound weight limit. I assume that, well, I don't know if that means with passenger. And they say that this thing is expected to cost between $200,000 and $300,000. But it's a helicopter. And you can't just have autonomous helicopters flying people around to whatever, you know, destination they desire. I mean, the regulatory hurdles would seem to be insurmountable. I mean, do you think this is something that could eventually happen? Or do you see this as something that's just impractical and not really feasible in the national airspace?
You know, I think if people are worried about their neighbor's weed whacker noise, they got another thought coming when this thing fires up at their neighbors.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's going to be no doubt you'll hear it coming before you see it.
Oh, I just, the thought of having to listen to this much noise coming from across the fence, I can't see this in people's neighborhoods. You know, maybe I could see it from airports or helipads, but then that also kind of limits the utility as well.
Yeah, but honestly, too, I can't imagine if we're worried about drones, little baby drones, and their effect around airports. How in the world could you possibly keep tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these things from whacking into each other over a city? I mean, I don't think we're quite ready for this yet.
Actually, Google has a plan for that. And for sure, drones of this size would be incorporated in that plan. So there would be flight plans. There would be, aircraft service providers that would help sort out all the flight plans and keep the pass separate. So I am less concerned about that. But I just kind of look at $200,000 and I'm not going to be able to fly it from my neighborhood. I'm going to have to, you know, go to the airport or some other place. It just seems limited practicality.
Yeah, for that price, you could get a really nice used Cirrus.
For sure.
And that's a perfect segue to why don't you, before you get in, you have to get your Before You Fly smartphone app.
That's right. That's right, David. The FAA administrator, Michael Huerta, announced at CES the public release of this app, Before You Fly. It's for iOS right now. There's a beta version for Android that you can get. But the FAA says that this app tells you about current and upcoming requirements and restrictions in areas of the national airspace system where they may want to operate their unmanned aircraft system. And it's a free app, as you might think. And what you can do is if you look at your current location or you put in another location, it tells you what's around you. So, for example, if you are located within 5 miles of any airports or heliports, it gives you that information, shows you a map. David, you obviously, where you're located with the international airport there, you're well within the 5 mile zone. When I tried to, or when I installed the app and looked at it here in Connecticut, I found that I didn't even know it, that I was within 5 miles of just barely of a small GA airport, which I knew about, but I didn't know I was within 5 miles of it, within 5 miles of the heliport for a hospital in the next town over, and within 5 miles of some other heliport that I'd, you know, never heard of. I guess I can't fly in my backyard.
Well, I have yet to find a place that I can fly in. I've been using the app at my office, at Shell's work, and I have yet to be able to find a place. Well, find a place that this thing says I can fly a UAV. I know that that will make Rob very happy, but it's kind of...
Wait a minute. You guys are saying you can't fly there, and that's not accurate. Well, you can't fly there unless you make the proper notifications to the airport operator and or the airport control tower.
Right, which brings up a whole other bucket of worms because, some of the folks might know we do some work with airports too. And this topic before Christmas was insane because everybody said, well, if they call the airport, what are we going to do? Do we say, okay, thank you, and log their name, phone number, and address? Do we say, okay, go for it, as if we're giving them permission? Do we say, you can't fly no drones around here, because we know that's not true? And then the tower guy said, oh, no, we don't have anything to do with that at all. they have to call FAA down in Dallas. And, sure. And everybody was going, this notification thing, nobody has a clue. They still don't have a clue exactly what that means. And I think that's even more difficult. But again, I haven't heard it too much happening since Christmas.
And the reason
it's not a problem is most people aren't doing their notifications anyway. So.
Well, but Max T, where I'm sitting right now, this app says flight prohibited, period.
Yeah, and if you look at the Modernization Act, it just says you have to notify. It doesn't say that flight is prohibited, except in certain areas like now 30 miles from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, well, but David, I'll bet you – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm in Class B Area A, Philadelphia Class B Area A.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say is that anybody beneath the 30-mile – anybody beneath the Class B that goes down to the ground is going to get a prohibited – because you can't fly these things in Class B under any circumstances.
Ben, you're in New York there, where we know we've seen a lot of reports of people flying quadcopters up close to airliners and things like that. Is this a topic that's pretty hot in your area? Is it something that you talked about at NYC Aviation?
It's something that Phil Derner and I talk about all the time. We debate what the greater threat is, drones or lasers.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes, there's a threat there. The issue I had going through the app was I punched in every address I could think of in about a 20-minute span. I could only find one address that was unrestricted. But the other thing I noticed was that some of these little airports are owned by private individuals, sometimes out of state. And what if you call and nobody picks up?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Leave a message. You've notified the operator.
Well, and then the legal beagles have said, well, what's the definition of notify? Is it what you guys just said? Leave a message at the tone. We'll call you back. Beep. You know, and that's it. Or do you need something more? It depends on where you are, because those answers seem to change too.
And I think given the nature of the people flying these aircraft, that you need very specific information. And that has not come out really at any point in this whole process of trying to integrate drones into the airspace.
Yeah, we're definitely in the wild, wild west phase of this. If you were to call 10 FAA offices and ask them these questions, you'd get at least 15 answers.
Can I throw one thing into the conversation, too, is that I talked to a contact in a particular agency within the federal government that looks at these, who shall go nameless, and it shall go nameless. But they said that the reason they don't know is that the whole concept of this notification for drones and all that junk came out of the FAA reauthorization bill a couple of years ago, which demanded that people have access to airspace for drones with, you know, some kind of notification process. And the Congress basically gave it to the FAA and said, here you go. And so imagine the FAA trying to get some kind of an explanation out of the Congress. That hasn't been easy either.
Yeah, yeah. And I think really what this is it's an example of when technology marches ahead at its typical fast rate and it meets, I don't want to say bureaucracy, but it meets regulatory agencies that are used to a methodical, careful, deliberate progression of, fact collecting and data analysis to arrive at good decisions. And the two just don't mix very well. So we're kind of left with this situation where, we've got some half steps forward. We might have some steps back. Over time, it kind of moves forward, but technology doesn't really wait for time. So it's a big issue. Well, we're talking about the FAA here. FAA is involved in a few other things as well. We see in a Reuters news report, FAA fails to ensure pilots' manual flying skills. And this comes from a U.S. department, or rather a U.S. Transportation Department Office of the Inspector General that released a report saying the FAA is not ensuring that airline pilots maintain the skills that they need to take control from automated systems during an emergency. Max Trescott, why are we hearing this now?
I don't think it's particularly new, but it just happens to be a new Inspector General report that just came out on January the 7th. I searched for it on the U.S. Department of Transportation website just by searching for manual skills and quickly found the title of the report, Enhanced FAA Oversight Could Reduce Hazards Associated with Increased Use of Flight Deck Automation. And I know we've talked in the past about how there is a real challenge for pilots, whether they fly for the airlines or whether they fly small aircraft, that as we get more and more automation in the cockpit and people come to rely on it even more, there tends to be a belief that some of the manual flying skills are deteriorating. And so in the report, it says that, not only is this an issue because pilots have fewer opportunities to use their manual flying skills, but they say the FAA does not have a sufficient process to assess a pilot's ability to monitor flight deck automation systems and manual flying skills, both of which are important for handling unexpected events during flight. So essentially, the Inspector General is saying, hey, this is a problem, and they're right. I think we've talked about this before, and Rob, you'd probably agree that this has been something that's been coming for a long time.
Well, sure, and the other issue that I know from people inside the airline industry, and even within the training realm, the Part 142 schools, that's the you know, the flight safeties, the CAE, the simu flights, have said, look, where do we tell these people to manually fly? At what point should they do the landing manually from the final approach fix inbound? Should they do the takeoff manually from the ground through 18,000 feet? Should they do a couple of Dutch rolls on the way into, you know, the pattern at Kennedy? Nobody has defined that either. So that's another problem. Everybody knows they need it, but nobody has decided exactly what it is that they should do to keep those skills up.
And Rob, that's a part that scares the bejeebers out of me, because I'm going to finish the month of January with over 25,000 miles. And it concerns me that some pilots might not be as competent as they should be in actually flying the aircraft, especially if something happens.
What airline do you have all those miles with?
It's a mixture, but most of them, as you know, are with United.
And how's that worked out so far?
I'm still here today, so it's worked out okay so far. But it's not the everyday flight that I'm concerned about. It's when something goes wrong. That's when I want the competent pilot.
Look at the safety record. Last U.S. airline have fatal accident here in the U.S. was, what, 2009? I mean, it's the safest form of transportation, bar none.
Well, can I throw one monkey wrench in there? The one thing that we don't know, and I agree, Max, I really do, but the one thing that we never figure into our discussions about safety is the number of incidents that go on where something happened and it was a close call, but the crew pulled it out. Mm. And that, you know, if it had been a lesser pilot or a more severe weather situation or some other thing, it could have been a disaster. And believe me, there are a lot of those out there. And I'm not beating the people up because they were able to pull it out. I'm just saying that there are some pretty close calls out there on record.
Yeah, and I said when we opened this show that I'd seen some interesting instrument flying today. I do a lot of training and had a gentleman who, for whom we turned off the automation and reduced some of the, simulated the failure of some of the instruments. And oh my gosh, it was a wild ride at that point. So he's not, doesn't have his instrument rating yet, but, it was clear that he needs more practice on being able to transition to backup gauges when the primary instrument's not available.
This was in a Cirrus, correct?
Let's see. Today was actually in a Cessna 182, though. Oh, okay. You're right. I probably spend about 80% of my time in Cirruses.
Well, we also see that the FAA has issued a new advisory circular for instructors that addresses hand-flying skills for GA aircraft as well, haven't we?
Yeah, so this is a new advisory circular. So the FAA has a whole series of so-called ACs. So if you want the number on it, it's AC61-98C. C means it's an update of an earlier version. And essentially, it's got a lot of information in terms of, background of what's required for pilots from a proficiency standpoint, what instructors have to do to help them maintain proficiency. And it's got some additional recommendations on things that instructors should be looking for when they are doing these recurrent training exercises with pilots. There's an interesting section in here that talks about criteria for stabilized approaches conducted in GA aircraft. And this is something I think that probably doesn't get emphasized enough in GA flight training. Pilots often hear that the best predictor of a good landing is a good approach. But what does a good approach mean? And they actually spell out seven different criteria here. Things like the aircraft is on the correct flight path and the bank angle. The heading is the airplane's on the extended center line. The airspeed's within plus 10 or minus 5 knots, the recommended landing speed, descent rate not greater than 500 feet. So it really quantifies the things that pilots should be looking for, when they're on final approach to minimize the chance of a landing that ends up in a mishap.
Yeah, and the one other aspect of that we haven't figured out how to deal with yet are those people that get close to those guidelines and then say, well, yeah, I know I'm 12 knots high and I'm 400 feet at a, quarter mile final, but I can make this work. Mm. And then they find out later that they couldn't.
Yeah, and the one of the clubs that I fly with analyzed all the incidents that they had a while back, and what they determined was that 80% of them could have been avoided by a timely go-around. And what that really means is pilots, you know, need not to shouldn't be trying to save every landing. Best guidance I ever heard was, you know, at the first point in your mind, you start to think, maybe I should go around. That's a really good time to decide to go around.
Ben, you're not a pilot, are you?
I'm not.
Me either. Boy, does this stuff scare you? I mean, I'm happy to remain the enthusiast and let the let these guys and the professionals figure out all this piloting stuff.
I agree completely, and I don't think this is just a problem with the FAA. We've now seen two airliner crashes where the automation stopped working properly and the pilots couldn't fly the plane. Both Air France 447 and Air Asia Flight 8501, which was just over a year ago.
Yeah, these automation issues have been certainly in the news in the last couple of years as a result of these things. Do you think, I'll ask Rob and Max Trescott, do you think that changes have been made, significant changes have been made that make these kinds of failures less likely, or is the industry still kind of struggling with that?
Ooh, well, my particular perspective is that with the numbers of new pilots that we're adding to the system all over the world, and many of them outside the United States, especially in Europe, are coming on as part of the multi-crew licensing scheme, which essentially means that most of their training is done in a simulator. And so, you know, they until recently, there haven't even been simulators that were capable of recreating some of the problems that have caused these losses of control. And so, you know, how do you train somebody for something and say, well, okay, I know this is what it's doing now, but in real life, this is what would happen. And the student looks over and goes, oh, okay, well, I'm darn sure not going to do that then. But it doesn't work like that in a panic. It's all different.
Wow.
And I look at the practical test standard, which is what the FAA provides as guidelines, well, more than guidelines, requirements to examiners. And it's also what a lot of instructors use for teaching pilots. And there is very, very little in the PTS that addresses automation, which means that automation probably doesn't get taught as well as it may need to, because, you know, people are looking to help pilots graduate in the shortest amount of time. And so they teach them to the test. And then you go one other step beyond that and you look at airline pilots. Here in the U.S., we've got a robust general aviation environment, so a lot of airline pilots are out there flying small planes on weekends, so they're getting, you know, a lot of practice and of, you know, manual skills and not just pressing buttons in the cockpit. You go overseas, and that doesn't exist. Most overseas pilots really don't have the opportunities to go out, you know, flying around on weekends, so I think it's probably a bigger challenge for them.
All right, one other item. And this is from Qantas. It's actually a press release from Qantas. It's titled, "That Time When We Strapped an Extra Engine Onto a Jumbo." And this is about Qantas ferrying a Rolls-Royce engine from Sydney to Johannesburg so that it could be used on another 747. And what they did is attached it to basically a fifth pylon on the wing. And thus we have a, of course, it was unpowered, right? This is not connected, not generating thrust, not running, just being carried. But it's a convenient way to carry a large jet engine. Kind of interesting. We have a video. This came from John Walton, I think, that sort of shows this stuff. But a lot of people look at this and, you know, thought, wow, five engines on a plane. How often do you see that?
And Max, how do they usually move engines around the country? I mean, obviously, this doesn't look like the standard method.
Inside the airplane.
Yeah, so why, you think with all the drag that this would produce, wouldn't, I guess, were they carrying so much cargo where it was more valuable or easier to stick it on the outside of the aircraft than on the inside?
Well, considering it was a passenger plane, it wasn't going to fit in the cargo bag.
Well, but you know, I guess what I'm surprised at is that maybe it said this, but I thought it looked like the kind of installation that they use to test a new kind of an engine. Yeah, but that's I can't imagine them spending the time and the money to build a pylon to hold that sucker just to move it from point A to point B. That was a big deal to get that thing onto that airplane. So, but I don't know. That's what I looked at. That's what it looked like to me.
It's actually an off-the-shelf solution, and it's not the first time that Qantas has done this or that any airline has done this. Qantas last did it, I believe, in 2011.
Oh, so it's not just duct tape, huh?
No, no, it's an actual hard point built into the engine designed just for this purpose. It also used to be done on aircraft such as the 707, L-1011, DC-8, DC-10. The new model, the 747-8, does not have this capability.
Wow.
But the alternative for them here was to either put it on a boat and ship it across the Indian Ocean, which would take about 3 weeks, or to charter a freighter jet to fly it. When you weigh those three options, suddenly strapping it to the underside of the wing isn't such a bad idea, maybe.
But there's no other freighter jet that's going within those 3 weeks. And even still, I find it hard to believe that the engine is large enough where it still wouldn't fit inside the passenger cargo, you know, the cargo area of the passenger jet.
I can see why that wouldn't. Yeah, because when you take an engine and you put it on an engine stand, right, you don't just, you know, toss the engine in. It has to be bolted to an engine stand, yeah, which is, you know, as you might suspect, is very large, very heavy. I don't think that would fit in a passenger jet. You know, in a cargo plane, that's different.
If you're in the Air Force, you slide it into a 130 or a C-5 or a C-17, and away you go.
Away you go.
Ironically, that's why the Blue Angels fly with Fat Albert, because they can throw two F-18 engines inside of it. But in this case, it was the cheapest way, and they didn't lose a revenue flight, and they didn't lose an aircraft sitting on the ground for revenue for 3 to 4 weeks.
Clearly, they thought about this ahead of time, and the pylon was sitting in the maintenance hangar, so they must have planned to do this all along, or they've done it before.
The other five-engine 747 that I know about is the Pratt & Whitney test aircraft. They have a flying test bed, which is a 747SP, a really old airplane. I think it was originally delivered to Korean in the early 80s, somewhere along the way. And Pratt & Whitney picked it up, and they will replace one of the four engines with a new engine if it's somewhere near the right thrust range, and test it there. But they also use it for testing the geared turbofan engines. And what they did is build a little horizontal kind of pylon off the top hump and hang a GTF engine there. And of course, in this case, the engine operates as a test engine. So that's another kind of a five-engine 747 that's out there.
Yeah, and that's a great photo. I'm assuming you're going to put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, sure. We'll put that in the show notes, yeah. Again, we're speaking with our guest, Ben Granucci from NYC Aviation. Ben, again, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
NYC Aviation, I think we've talked about the history of it a little bit in the past, but just to refresh our listeners and so our new listeners who may not be familiar with the site can learn about it. It kind of evolved in its mission over time, would you say?
It really did. NYC Aviation is a community. It's a collaborative effort for all to enjoy and contribute to. We can really only get done what we work together to accomplish. It started out very New York City centric. It was started as a kind of a place for the local plane spotters to build a community. Before NYC Aviation was around, one of the longtime spotters I know had never met anybody in New York. He only met Phil when they both attended Airliners International in Los Angeles and ran into each other and, oh, you're from New York too?
Phil, of course, is Phil Derner Jr., who's really founded the site, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Along with Matt Molnar.
Along with Matt. Okay. Yes. So, I mean, that was kind of the origin of it. But over time, it really grew in scope to be much more than just a regional website.
Yeah, we have people participate from around the world now. We have one plane spotter who is a Qatar Airways captain. And about every other month, he will add a selection of photos to an ongoing thread he has on our forums.
And so how many folks are sort of regular contributors or writers for NYC Aviation?
Ooh, that's tough. We have a staff of about 8 at the moment, if I'm counting correctly.
Oh. And then lots of other people that kind of write on more of a freelance basis, probably?
Exactly. Some more frequently than others, but we're always looking to add to our writing staff, to be honest.
Now, I mean, as plane spotters, you're obviously, you know, as a group interested in photography. And do I understand that there's a new feature coming in NYC Aviation? Tell us about that.
We have been working on for several years now a new photo database, something along the lines of what airliners.net or jetphotos.net do. But we've done a little bit of rethinking with it. We found that a lot of people don't like the games that get played. They don't like having to have every photo of theirs screened. They don't like having to wait for their photos to be put online until they've been screened. So we kind of done a little bit of a rethinking. We're doing a tag-based platform where you will upload a photo and then you will add tags for the aircraft, make and model, the airline it's flying for, where you took the photo, and then if there are certain special attributes, sort of if it's a special livery, for example.
And so that makes it easily searchable.
It makes it easily searchable, and it makes adding the information once, as the database grows, adding that information will become very quick for the photographers because the information's already going to be in there. All you have to do is say, type in a registration, and it will fill out the entire make model section for you.
Hmm. I'm curious how spotters, how aviation photographers view the use of their photos. We certainly are almost always in a search for photographs that can accompany the show notes for this podcast, for these episodes. And we always try to make sure we have the permission of the photographer who holds the copyright and so forth. Sometimes it's difficult, though. Do plane spotters generally worry much about their photos being used by others in different places?
In my experience, very much so. Most people I know, there are some people out there who are just happy to see their photos get the attention.
Hmm.
But most want to be recognized that they're the ones who took it. They want to know where their photos are being used. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who just think they can use photos without even attempting to give credit.
Hmm.
And it's kind of a shame. Photographers pour thousands of dollars into their equipment collection.
Sure.
And the return on it is monetarily very little for most.
So Ben, do you compensate people for the photos or they all donate them with the copyright to you?
So for a photo database, this is kind of a place where photographers are looking to share certain photos. We're not compensating for photos. It's more what people want to share, knowing that their name, their contact information is all going to be tied to that photo. And it's a situation where they're giving the photo rather than somebody coming and taking it.
So are they contributing it to the public domain, in effect, or it's not that open?
It's not that simple. Actually, one of our features is you'll be able to select which level of copyright you want to apply. Whether you want to retain full control, you can put it under one of several Creative Commons licenses.
Perfect.
You can retain full control and give us the right to use it in our articles. There's probably 6 or 8 different options that we've given photographers for them to choose.
Yeah, that's great. And hopefully tied with that is ease in contacting the photographer, because I know several times in the past we found photographs that would be just perfect to illustrate something in the show notes, and we try to contact the photographer, and you know, we can't. Either we don't know how to, or it takes so long to hear back that, you know, we've had to move on by that point. So yeah, being able to contact the photographer is an important thing. You mentioned screening, and what is the process, the screening process that you're expecting for this capability in NYC Aviation?
So what we're looking to do is, instead of screening on a per photo basis, we want to screen you as a photographer. So when a new photographer comes to NYC Aviation and looks to add their photos to our database, we're going to ask them to submit 25 photos. So they will upload those photos, they will add the tags, and then we're going to have a team of, we're calling them dispatchers. It's a little more friendly sounding than screeners.
Yeah.
Our dispatcher team will review the portfolio, and they may find certain ones where they haven't been properly tagged, where they just don't quite meet our standards, and they can send those back individually for the photographer to either correct, upload a new photo, whatever. Once they have 25 approved photos, they become what we are calling unleashed. And from and from there,
I like that.
You upload a photo, you tag it, it's live for the world to see.
Hmm. What's the timeline like? I guess you've been running a beta. Has that been a public beta?
It's been a private beta.
Private.
Invitation only. We started a little over a year ago. And that's kind of tailed off over the last few months as we've started to move into the next phase. We're looking to launch it in about 2 months.
Oh, great. Well, yeah, be sure to let us know, and we'll pass that along to our listeners as well, those who aren't regularly following NYC Aviation, which of course they should.
Absolutely.
Speaking of following, NYC Aviation follows along with different kinds of events and things and provides coverage of them. What are some examples of some of the events that either you or the site in general has been covering lately?
Beginning of December, Qatar Airways brought an A350 to JFK. It was the first time an airline had brought an A350 to the U.S., albeit not a scheduled flight, it was a charter. And they planned basically 3 days of events around it. And I was able to attend all 3 days.
Yeah, you published in NYC Aviation a photo tour.
Yes. Kind of a new format for us, something we were trying out. And we think it worked out pretty well. A good way to present an article where the photos can really do most of the talking with just a little bit of explanation about what you're looking at.
Yeah, yeah. What were your impressions of the A350?
I was honestly shocked. It's an impressive piece of aircraft.
What are some of the notable features of the interior, let's say, that you saw?
I enjoyed the large windows. I liked the apparent space on board, especially in economy class. Granted, it's hard to tell when you don't have 300 of your closest friends sitting in the same cabin with you.
Sure.
But 9 seats across in that width of a cabin just seemed pretty spacious to me.
Does it have a different feel than a Boeing plane, than a 777, for example?
In some ways, but nothing really significant, in my opinion.
How was the attendance? I mean, were the crowds large to come see this? And who did come to see it? Was it mostly news organizations, or was this open to the general public?
Generally speaking, it was invited guests only, invited press only.
Oh, okay.
We were given permission to share that it was coming only once it was airborne. So several of us stayed up very late the night before, and as soon as it was in the air, we're putting it all over Twitter and Facebook saying, "Hey guys, look what's coming tomorrow." So there was a pretty large contingent of plane spotters out, I'm told, and a small smattering of media that were actually at the inside the airport for the arrival.
Now, NYC Aviation has some spotting guides that not just for the New York City area, but other areas as well. Can you tell us about those?
So this is something that we're actually in the midst of doing a revamp of. Right now we have spotting guides for airports in London, Los Angeles, Boston, Florida, Washington, D.C., Las Vegas, and Seattle. And that's in addition to four of the New York City area airports and one upstate. And those guides have written descriptions of what locations you'd be plane spotting from, tips for photography, such as what lenses you might want to have there, what the security environment is, things like that. And a couple of the guides also have maps. We had an issue, and a lot of other websites had issues with embedded maps from Google a few years ago. Google changed the API and basically shut off everybody's map overnight.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem.
It was, yeah. And there was no rapid solution for fixing that. So the easy thing to do was just take the maps down for a while. Google has come out with a great new mapping tool in the last year or so, and we've started slowly recreating the maps. We're also looking to greatly expand our plane spotting guides. We want to make it a comprehensive list. It's not something that you really find anywhere else, at least in such a way that I can go and say, hey, I wonder what it's like to plane spot in Tokyo, and be able to look up a guide there. And, you know, that's our goal, is to have a comprehensive list from airports around the world.
Wow, that's fantastic. I think that's something that a lot of people would appreciate. If you work on a guide for Hartford, Connecticut, that'll make me happy. But I know there's a lot of bigger fish out there before you get to that.
Ben, I bet you don't have one for Chicago O'Hare, do you?
We do not yet. It's actually on my short list.
Good luck with that.
Why do you say that, Rob?
Well, it wasn't that long ago. I was out with somebody trying to do some plane spotting. And the way O'Hare is built, there are roads, fairly busy roads, almost all the way around it. So you can't just pull off on a shoulder and say, well, hey, let's just stop here for a while and we'll take some pictures, and because the cops won't let you do that. There is one interior road on the east side of the airport that runs between a bunch of parking lots and the approach end of a couple of runways. And I got chased out of there. Oh, this was last summer, actually. And they said, you can't park here. You can't do that. I thought, well, okay. So the guy that was with me, I said, here, why don't you take the car, park it across the street, and then walk back, and I'll just stay here with the cameras. And so then after we did that, it was just the two of us, and he had one of those monster lenses. I don't know, 60,000 millimeter. Oh, I don't know what size it was, but, you know, it was big. Yeah. And the cop came back. He said, I told you guys to get the hell out of here. I said, I thought you said we couldn't park a car. He said, no, you can't even be here pointing anything at an airplane. Uh-huh. I said, we're taking pictures. And he said, I don't care. Get out of here or – and then he – kind of touched his handcuffs, and I said, oh, man, you know. Yeah. But so I haven't found any place that's good around O'Hare. There are a few spots around Midway, but not many. You can see them when they're landing and taking off, but really no place that you can watch them, you know, move around on the ground or anything like that.
I'm surprised you didn't take on the Chicago PD. I mean, what's up with that?
Yeah, did you see that video that surfaced there a couple of weeks ago, guys? You know, the poor kid that got shot 16 times. No, thank you.
Yeah, I think yes, sir, and move right along is the correct answer.
What the key is for us to adding new guides is we need to have somebody on the ground who knows the spots, knows what the environment there is. We don't want places where there's a decent likelihood or better that the police or security are going to show up and chase you off, or worse, because that doesn't do anything to promote the hobby.
So you want a map of my front doorstep?
Well, we don't want people, you know, plane spotting on people's front lawns either, unless they are explicitly welcomed there.
Yeah, everybody over to David's house.
You know, in New York, we have a collection of mostly parks and parking lots that we use.
I like the idea that it was Miami, I think, and one other airport that really embraced plane spotters and used them as, well, in sort of a synergistic way, allowing the spotters to do the stuff that they would like to do, but also using them as sort of the eyes and ears on the ground and around the perimeter in terms of security. I thought that was a great idea.
It's funny you should mention that. The other airport is O'Hare.
Oh, is it?
Yep. They have their airport watch group. They've received the blessing of creating this with local law enforcement, and having that blessing is really key to making that work. We've tried for many years to make that happen in New York, and it's just not realistic for us, unfortunately.
Hmm. Now, we know that Rob has been down to St. Martin and enjoyed the interesting plane spotting opportunities down there. NYC Aviation has been looking at that as well, have they? Were you down there yourself?
I was down there myself. It was a much needed and long awaited vacation. It's been at the top of my list for almost as long as I've been plane spotting. And to finally be able to get down there was great. It's probably one of the best destinations in the world if you're looking to plane spot. It's got a beach. It's got good, warm weather most of the time. There's a huge variety of aircraft from private planes all the way up to wide bodies. You are unbelievably close to the aircraft, sometimes closer than you might be comfortable with.
In those videos that we see from down there, that's not trick photography or some funny camera angle, huh? That's the way it really is.
Those are pilots showing off. You know, they know that they have a beach full of people that are there to see them fly. And some of them, especially the Caribbean-based airlines, will have pilots that will do a little showing off.
Are all those people on the beach, are those locals or are those tourists?
Those are primarily tourists.
Yeah.
You have a few locals there with different means of trying to make their living.
I can assure you all those people hanging on the fence there or standing right there, there's absolutely no alcohol involved.
No, not at all. The bars that bookend the beach play absolutely no role in what goes on. you know what? The amazing thing I realized my first day sitting on Maho Beach is that every single person there wants to have something to do with airplanes, if only for that day.
Yeah, I guess so. That's a good way to look at it. And that's a great thing, right? People immersed in aviation feeling it really, you know, right in their face, I guess.
It's a great way to unite a community.
There you go.
It really is. And if 1% of them say, you know, hey, that was a fun thing to do on our, you know, day on our cruise stop when we were in St. Martin, you know, maybe we can do it around here, you know, and then they start looking online and they find places like NYC Aviation that have information for them, yes. Then that's mission accomplished for us.
Good. Well, Ben, sometimes when you're plane spotting, I guess you can just be in the right place at the right time and observe something out of the ordinary. And I guess there was a plane crash that you observed that sort of falls into that category. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah. So at the end of last August, the New York Air Show, it was the first time that they held this air show up at Stewart International Airport, which is about 60 miles north of New York City. And I was there providing coverage for the website. This was my actually second day on site, and the air show didn't start until the following morning. But I had that morning been offered the chance to ride on a B-25, which took a couple hours of time. And I came back and caught the shuttle out to where the media was. And here was this air show performer in his little two-seat carbon fiber plane. And I had never heard of this guy before. I came to find out afterwards that he was a very accomplished airshow performer who just never really performed in this part of the country because of where he was based. It only made sense for him to come up here because he could do two shows in the span of a few days. So he takes off, flies a couple passes, and on probably his second or third pass, he came down in a dive towards the center of the runway, pulled up, went into an aerobatic roll, and as he got up to about 1,000 feet, he appeared to stall, which at first I thought that was just part of his act, until I saw the plane start flying towards where the audience would be, and I knew something was gravely wrong at that point. That's kind of the cardinal sin of airshow performances, is you never are directing your energy towards the crowd. Time sort of slowed down for me for a minute. I knew what was happening. I knew it was inevitable. And I just stood there thinking to myself, come on, pull out of it, pull out of it, pull out of it. And he made it across where the crowd would have been. He made it just beyond the airport, the fence surrounding the runway, and just started slowly falling downwards. And eventually he went behind a small hill from our position. And then, you know, you think of a plane crash, you think of big crash sound, explosion, smoke, none of that. It was the most muffled little crunching sound. And you just knew what had happened, and it was kind of heart-wrenching.
It must have had given you a pit in your stomach.
For days.
Yeah.
It still does, to be honest.
Yeah, it's one thing to read about plane crashes or events like that or anything where there's loss of life. I assume the pilot didn't survive this.
No, the pilot passed away as a result of the accident. And a little while after the crash, while we were waiting on the airshow organizers to come tell the media what was going on, I started just flipping through my photos on my camera. And I looked at one, I'm like, blurry. Went to the next one, blurry. Went to the next one, zoomed in. Oh my word, the tail is missing. And I went back to the previous two shots, and what I had seen as blurry was actually the tail detaching from his aircraft.
Wow.
So the first thing I did was I took those three photos and sent them to a friend of mine who works for the FAA. And then we started passing them to different news organizations around the world.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that you were able to capture that. Talk about being at the right place at the right time.
It is. You know, it's something that I always had a feeling that I might witness. It's not that crashes are terribly common at air shows. It's not that air shows are unsafe by their very nature. Everything at an air show is designed around safety, particularly for the spectators, but also for the performers as well. But I knew that it was always a possibility, and it just so happened on that day that I was in the right place at the right time.
Hey, Max T, did you ever did you ever see an accident in your career?
Oh, boy. I've never actually watched a fatal occur. I've watched some incidents, and I've been on the scene within a few minutes of fatals. Unfortunately, I lost a number of friends in Ensenada, Mexico back in, 2000. Six folks, passed away on an A320 on a downwind to base turn. Went to four funerals the following week. Not good.
Yeah. I watched a Cessna 150 spin into the ground with a student pilot on it. Oh, this is a long time ago, but I never forgot. It was when I was still a controller, and the lady that was working the tower frequency just shouted out. We were all just standing around, you know, doing what controllers do when they're not talking to airplanes, just shooting the breeze. And somebody said, blank, blank, look. And I just watched this 150 make about three turns and go straight down, and that was it. And it was just, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. I just never seen anything like that happen. And I didn't even know what to say. I don't even know if you can know what to say, but it was surrealistic.
putting together a presentation for accidents in the Bay Area over the last 10 years, and I realized that out of the roughly 60 fatal accidents, I knew several of the people personally and had flown in a couple of the airplanes. So, yeah, I think the trouble is as a pilot, you know, the longer you're around, the more of these, you know, things you become associated with.
And one of the most important takeaways that I had from it was that people who witness these events need the support of people around them. And that day and in the following days, I was on both the giving and receiving end of that. And I think it helped the people that I gave support to, and I know it helped me.
Yeah, that's a time when, you know, you really need people to show the humanity that, you know, that we have, that I think all of us have somewhere inside. Sometimes it's buried. And it's kind of unfortunate that it can take an event like that to, you know, to bring that out. But yeah, I fully understand how that's, you know, kind of critical if you've been, you know, that close to an accident like this.
Absolutely.
Just amazing. Just amazing.
As NYC Aviation's web developer messaged me, he had seen a crash at the McGuire Air Force Base air show many years ago. And he said, it sticks with you. And it really does.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right. Well, Ben, tell our listeners where they can find NYC Aviation as well as you personally online.
You can find me at BL Granucci on Twitter. I'm trying to post more of my photos onto Instagram. I'm BL Granucci there as well. You can find many of my articles along with those many other talented writers at nycaviation.com. And be sure to follow NYC Aviation on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook as well. And I also occasionally contribute over at airlinereporter.com.
Yeah, another great place to go for good aviation content.
So. It really is.
So, and if you're looking for Ben, it's Granucci, Granucci.
Correct.
All right. Well, Ben, again, thanks for joining us. It's been a very interesting conversation. A lot of different things to think about. Maybe we'll help introduce some other folks to the fun world of plane spotting, get them involved in that.
Funny fact, I came to try out plane spotting for the first time because many years ago, I heard Phil Derner Jr. on this very podcast, and I believe it was episode 83, yeah, talking about plane spotting. And that put the spark into my head. So
really?
Hopefully, oh, wow. Yes. So hopefully this does the same for some more people.
Wow.
Because it really is an awesome hobby that's great fun.
So again, Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Really loved it.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. Well, there's been an awakening. Have you felt it? The ugly and even uglier. I've accused the English Electric Lightning of being ugly. Well, to prove that point, that I understand that we here in the old US of A can make really ugly airplanes. Even though I've presented the Fisher P-75 Eagle as an example, I'm going to present tonight the epitome of WTF, or to paraphrase the Wild Weasel community, YGTBSM, where you've got to be blanking me. Northrop's Tacit Blue. In December of 1976, DARPA awarded a contract for BSAX, or the Battlefield Surveillance Aircraft Experimental. This program was to create an aircraft that could operate close to the front lines of a battlefield undetected. The BASX would be part of a larger program called Pave Mover. Pave Mover would wield a suite of wide area surveillance radars designed to map the battle zone for target classification, acquisition, and targeting. Pave Mover's suite of systems were combined and merged into a Boeing 707s, becoming Northrop Grumman's E-8 Joint Surveillance Target Attack Radar System, otherwise known as Joint Stars. Joint Stars would see its operational debut in Operation Desert Storm in 1991. But back to the whale or the alien school bus. Tacit Blue was flown by a crew of one. Its slab-sided, straight-winged aircraft is 56 feet long with a 48-foot wingspan. Two Garrett ATF-3 high-bypass turbofans were enclosed in the boxy fuselage. The engines were originally from a drone, the high-altitude YQM-98 Compass Cope R. The civilian version was powered the Dassault Falcon 200 and 20G. The two engines were fed through a large duct, or the blowhole, on the top of the fuselage. Their exhausts were diffused by overflowing the V-tailplanes and mixed with outside air, reducing the infrared signature. At the time, it had the coolest exhaust of any aircraft flying. The surfaces were curvilinear with rounded edges. This was in direct response to Lockheed's solutions for stealth, which were facets. Tacit blue would eventually be the proof that the B-2 would work. Did I say the whale was ugly? Like many projects in the black, Tacit blue would be used off-the-shelf components. Like the F-117, the X-29, and any control-configured vehicles, it shouldn't fly. The aircraft was a fly-by-wire loosely based on the F-16. The computer decided what the pilot was trying to input. The ejection seat was by McDonnell Douglas, and the landing gear was from an F-5. The whale first flew on February 4, 1982, piloted by Dick Thomas. The last flight lasted a little over an hour. The program continued for another 123 flights over 300 hours, ending on Valentine's Day in 1985. All flights were flown from Groom Lake, otherwise known as Area 51. Upon completing the testing, the white whale was retired. On April 30th, 1996, the white whale came out of the black and is now displayed at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. While Tacit Blue never entered production, it paved the way for the B-2A Spirit. Its sensor skin can be seen in the F-22 and F-35. And if you look closely at the General Atomics Predator C, the drone has all the looks of the white whale. That being said, it is the ugliest aircraft ever flown, and we will have pictures in the show notes. So with that, this is David M. Vanderhoof with a very brief airplane history this week.
Boy, David, you're right. That is one odd-looking airplane.
No, ugly. It's ugly.
You know, there's an old joke that helicopters only fly because they're so ugly that the earth repels them. I don't know if that's true, but I'm pretty sure that's the case with Tacit Blue.
Very unique. All right, thanks for that, David. Rob Mark, you came up with an idea recently that is kind of interesting.
Well, this actually, I don't want to take credit for it because it wasn't my idea.
It wasn't your idea.
No, it was David's.
No, it's not mine. This is all yours.
I'm just kidding. No, actually, I was following a conversation, a string on one of the NBAA forums, which is the Business Aviation Association, and a bunch of the pilots just got started talking about, well, you know, in the old days, I remember when I got into this airplane, I thought it was the coolest thing in the whole world. And these are people that are flying some, you know, a variety of big airplanes from Boeing BBJs, you know, the business version of the 737 down to Gulfstreams and Global Expresses and Falcons and then down into the turboprops and all kinds of things. And this whole conversation started about, well, so my favorite airplane was always, somebody said that they got started with the MU-2, which was a twin engine turboprop that, I don't know, Max T, you might know better than I. It hadn't been made in, I don't know, maybe 25 years or something like that. But anyway, the point was, is that they were just, it was so interesting to listen to all of these people talk about what their favorite airplane was and why. I thought, I wonder what our listeners might think is their favorite airplane. And or maybe the best we can hope for is one of three airplanes. I don't know. No more than that, I would say. But why don't you write us and let us know what you think? At least that was my idea. I mean, what do you guys think?
So are these airplanes that we've flown in or airplanes that we would like to fly in or think are really cool looking?
Just any of that. Any of those. It could be, wow, I always thought that was so cool when I would see one flying. Yeah, even if you've never been in it or even close up to it. But then why? I'm almost as interested in the why as I am which airplanes. You know, so that would be kind of cool, I thought. And so what I thought is if people wanted to, they can send us an email. In fact, I'll be guinea pig enough to say that They can send it to me at rob@jetwine.com, and I'll be happy to field all of the interesting viewpoints that people might have. And let's say, what, maybe till the end of the month or something, end of January, and just tell us, what's your favorite airplane? Why? Did you see one? Did you fly in it? Did you always like it when you were a kid? I don't know. I just thought it'd be kind of cool to see what the listeners are thinking.
Yeah, I love this. And I think you're right, Rob. The why is kind of the maybe the more interesting part of it. Interesting to see if people are, you know, is it performance? Is it looks? Is it, you know, some event in their life that they have an emotional attachment to, or, you know, any of those things. So look forward to that. So tell us again, Rob, where folks can send their favorite airplane.
They can send it to me, rob@jetwine.com. That's R-O-B. At JETWHINE.com. And maybe in the subject line, just make, what should we say, APG favorite plane or something, or, you know, something that tells me it's from the Airplane Geeks.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah.
All right. Now we've got Peter Johnson across the pond. He talks to one of my favorite aviation folks, Marissa Garcia. So here's Peter across the pond.
Today, we welcome back Marissa Garcia, flight chic herself. Marissa, welcome back across the pond.
Well, thank you, Peter. Nice to be back.
It's a very, very busy time for you. You've got some exciting projects you're working on. But I just wanted to go back to before Christmas, Marissa. You had the opportunity to fly on the A350 just before it entered service with Finnair. I love that aircraft. I think she's a very good-looking lady. And Finnair, I think, have done a fantastic job over the last year. But I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were about the aircraft. You got to fly on it. Don't know anyone else who has. What's she like?
Oh, she's beautiful. I'm really an A350 groupie, I have to say. I've been fortunate enough to see it when it was first revealed, flew on the Qatar Airways one, walked through the Vietnam Airways one. But as beautiful as the Qatar Airways aircraft is, the Finnair is just more my cup of tea when it comes to design.
Why is that, Marissa? What's so different about it?
It's so light and airy, and so it really reflects all the beautiful colors, and they have this amazing light display overhead with the Northern Lights, you know, similar to what Iceland Air did with their Dreamliner. But
yeah,
it really works. It's very elegant, and Finnair is also you know, a quality airline itself, and yeah, it was a wonderful experience. I was just sorry that it was a short flight.
Just before we come back to Finnair itself, what was it like comfort wise? I know nowadays, you know, long leg room and things like that are a thing of the past, but what was the cabin configuration like?
Well, I have to say, first of all, as a caution, that I am the last person to ask about legroom, because anybody who's seen me knows that I'm a midget. But the fact is that realistically, it is adequate legroom. It's comfortable. You know, yeah. I, my husband is 6'3", and I think he would be fine in it.
Right.
So that you know, I think that was good. And I was impressed also by the type of seat, the way it was configured with the IFE was nice and prominent. Everything was in its place. It felt like a place where you could work or relax or whatever you wanted to do. So I found it very comfortable in the economy cabin there. And I was not in the window seat, which was a shame. That was a heartache. But, you know, it was still very, very comfortable.
And what differences did you see between the three airlines that you were able to see the A350 on? What were the big differences?
You know, it is a lot of branding, and you can there's definitely a lot of cachet in the Qatar Airways cabin. The Vietnam Airlines cabin was very nice. It's just more straight from the catalog.
And
with Finnair, you had a nice balance between those two extremes. You had, you know, a cabin that was really technically catalog, but it was decorated so that it felt extremely custom. So it was a nice, smart balance. And again, it comes down to taste, Peter. You know, one person's going to get on there and say, how could you say it was beautiful when it was obviously not so beautiful? Obviously, it's what you like. And I happen to like that color scheme. I like that environment. What is wonderful about the A350, though, is that even when you get to a baseline product, you know, closer to what you had with B&M Airlines, you're still in a really awesome aircraft. So it's very difficult to say, I feel overwhelmed or crowded in this cabin, even though you will be next to companions for a long time. You have this tremendous overhead space, and the space is optimized. The windows are large. It all works together.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about Finnair. I just wanted to ask you very quickly about what your perception is of them. Last year grew almost 7% year on year. They've used themselves geographically, strategically, very, very well for the Asia routes. Co-chair agreement with Jetstar. They're really doing some good stuff, some great marketing before Christmas and over Christmas. They're really emerging from their shell a little bit.
They are really on the cutting edge in terms of strategy, I think. Everything that you're saying is absolutely true. They also have the joint ventures with One World Partners, and they make them very strong. But they also do some very clever things. You know, I flew Finnair to Singapore recently, and I love Singapore Airlines, but I chose Finnair because I wanted the advantage of that Helsinki connection. I just wasn't up to connecting through a larger airport. One of the things that really impressed me was not just the automatic follow-ups that they do with you as a customer to remind you that your flight is coming, but they entice you to buy up. You know, they give you an offer to bid for an upgrade, for example.
Right, okay.
And you can get a really good deal there. And their app works really well. So all of those little things are important. I admired that when I sat down at my economy seat, there was actually on my IFE screen a little offer that if I wanted to go to the extra legroom seat, I could do that.
Wow.
I could pay for that on the spot. Yeah. I wish I had, by the way. But that's a different story.
Hindsight's a great thing.
Exactly. But, you know, they really are very strong, and they're being very smart about how they use data. They're very, very smart about how they use digital. It's an airline that I think is going to continue going strong because it takes what it has as an asset and gets all the return it can out of those assets.
It's
very, very good.
Well, talking about squeezing the assets, one airline we know that does that very well is Ryanair. Now, it is a while ago, but I had it on my to-do list. It stayed on my to-do list for so long. You went to a press conference the last time we spoke on the show. We talked about Ryanair threatening to pull out of airports, but I just want to ask you one question. You got to see Michael O'Leary. What's he like in real life?
You know, he is one of the most savvy and down-to-earth human beings. I really respect him as a CEO because I'll tell you, we were in this small conference room in a reasonably priced hotel. and he walked in, sleeves rolled up, to put up the little signage. There was no staff to do that. He came in and did it himself. You don't see that. And that tells you a lot about the man. He is very upfront. He's very direct. He doesn't, mince words, and sometimes he can be outrageous. I think that's more intentional than anything else. But he's to be respected, I think, as a CEO. He's savvy, and he's also quite likable, I have to say.
Yeah, he came across as a bit endearing in that press conference, I have to say. We're running out of time, Marissa. We'll just leave on some sad news. As we record this, news is coming in of the loss of a Bombardier in Sweden. What do we know?
Well, we know it was a Norway postal flight, unfortunately. So it's we know that the pilot was a Spaniard and the co-pilot was a Frenchman. We do not know exactly what happened yet, except that there was a mayday call briefly before the aircraft just fell off the radar. It's a terrible thing, and you know, everybody's grieving over it and confused, of course. Because there doesn't seem to be a clear indicator of what caused that event. As
the CEO, I think, of West Atlantic said, what should not happen and may not happen has happened. And it is terribly shocking news. Yeah. And our condolences go out to the families and friends of the two pilots. Yes. But on that note, Marissa, I'm going to let you get back to your very exciting projects. We're going to look out for them. Where can we find out about you online?
Well, you can always visit me on flightcheek.com. That's C-H-I-C.com. And, of course, on Twitter at DesignerJet.
Of course, I've said it before, but Flight Chic is a great website. Love it. Some really original content on there. So if you haven't been to see Marissa's material, please do. Marissa, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, thank you, Peter and Marissa. Ben, I guess crashes of cargo aircraft don't always get the attention that the passenger aircraft get.
No, they sure don't. Unfortunately, there's still lives that have been lost, and you can really still learn just as much from a cargo crash as you can from a passenger crash. Last spring on NYC Aviation, Phil Derner wrote an article exploring three significant yet underreported cargo crashes, such as the UPS 747 that crashed in Dubai as a result of a battery fire, I believe it was.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that NYC Aviation article in the show notes for sure. It's titled Three Plane Crashes You Never Heard, Aviation's Sacrificial Lambs. We'll have that in the show notes. All right, a little bit of listener mail before we close this out. We heard from Roy Pettit. He's put together something that he calls the Jack Dunn Stories. And this is, it's information and stories about Jack Dunn, who's a career aviator. He flew from 1942 until 2001. He's 91 year old. And Roy listened to his stories and he decided that, you know what, he really needed to capture these in a way that they could be shared with others. So back in 2012, he began videotaping conversations with Jack about his remembrances. Now, Roy has put these together. He's in the process of putting them together, actually, and posting them on a YouTube channel. So we'll have a link in the show notes, but that's Jack Dunn Stories, Dunn with two N's, .weebly.com. Again, link in the show notes. Have a look at that. These are some great stories told by a first person, by someone who's actually lived them. So point that out to you. We also heard from Tom. Tom has a little bit of experience in his past with a SR-71. It's an interesting story. I think we're going to hold it until we have a little bit more time to relate that story. But just wanted to thank Tom for sending that along. And we also heard from Christopher on the Uber of the Skies kind of conversation. And this is something that's been generating a lot of interest from our listeners. Also in our Slack listener team, people are talking about that as well. And maybe we'll collect a little bit more of that and bring some of that to you. Generally, I think the position of most people, especially the pilot community, is that, yeah, this is kind of nuts. And there's a lot of problems associated with some kind of, you know, on-demand air taxi type of service. And whether that's sort of on a professional level or just GA pilots providing that there's a lot of issues about that. I think Max Trescott, I think you especially expressed some concerns about that last week.
Yeah, and in this particular input from the listener, he did, I think, at one point conflate two things. He was talking about you know, whether or not charter aircraft, you know, could use a, you know, put a, another passenger on, or, you know, something like that, some kind of sharing. And those may indeed be GA aircraft, but that's totally different operation. Those operators all have certificates. The key is the FAA requires anybody who's taking passengers for hire to have some type of operating certificate. And that's totally separate from any pilot license that a pilot might hold.
Yeah, and Hillel in the listener team, he brought up some points that relate to that. He said that there's really kind of three systems that, you know, would have to accommodate this, and that's pilot certification, legal, and insurance. And he makes the point that, you know, all three of those would have to just change drastically, that they're really significant hurdles. And that makes, you know, this kind of a Uber of the skies concept, you know, pretty difficult to imagine. We also heard from Tim. He sent us an article from the BBC. Tracy Curtis Taylor has flown her 1942 Boeing Stearman Spirit of Artemis from Farnborough to Sydney, and that essentially retraces the flight made by pioneer Amy Johnson in 1930. This was a 3-month flight, 14,600 nautical miles. She flew over 23 countries, some 50 refueling stops. Quite an accomplishment. Again, we'll have a link to that article in the show notes. Boy, you know, flying that far in a Stearman, boy, that's pretty difficult.
Yeah, I think Vicky Benzing was telling us on a past show about coming back from, what, Oshkosh to California. I forget how many days it was, but, you know, two-hour legs. Those planes don't carry a lot of fuel.
That's right. So good for her. And, again, link in the show notes. And then Rob sent us an article from NASA. NASA research could save commercial airlines billions in new era of aviation. And what this article points out is some of the technologies that have been developed by NASA, their environmentally responsible aviation project, that could really significantly cut airline fuel usage, pollution, noise, and so forth. And there's a list of a number of technologies, embedded nozzles, composite materials, morphing wing technology, compressor stage improvements, geared turbofans, and some other interesting technologies. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And want to thank Rob for passing that along. All right, with that, we'll bring this episode to a close. We want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Ben Granucci from NYCAviation.com. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you again for having me.
Where can folks find you on Twitter?
At BL Granucci, GRANUCCI.
All right, and let's see, Brian Coleman, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Oh, before I do that, I don't think we touched this last week. I just wanted to pass along our best wishes to Oscar over at United Airlines with his heart transplant. So hopefully he will get better and back at the job soon. And if anyone wants to get a hold of me, the best way to do so is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And Max Trescott, how about you?
Oh, a quick shout out to Airplane Geeks listener Fred Kish, who contacted me over the holidays about going flying. So we'll probably get something scheduled there at some point in time. But I would say folks can find me on Facebook, Twitter, or you can check out my flight training website at sjflight.com, short for SanJoseFlight.com.
And Rob Mark, where do people find you online?
Well, anything that's tied to Jetwine on Facebook, Twitter, website. Also find me around P1 Digital Magazine or at AOPA Pilots, Turbine Pilot section, or I don't know. I just all kinds of places. And do you realize how many days there are left until AirVenture 2016?
What's the countdown?
I don't have the slightest idea.
Oh, that was a question.
You guys could do the
math. I thought you were going to tell us.
Pretty quickly. But it's the numbers are growing smaller.
They sure are. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
You can find me at DM Vanderhoof on Twitter, arguing with people about lightnings, evidently. That seems to be a current theme. Or you can find me on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones and UAVs, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about Before You Fly and FAA regulations this week.
Ah, yes. All right, good. And I'm Max Flight. Find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Also look for me on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby on the PaxXPodcast.com. You can find us at AirplaneGeeks.com. Show notes for this episode, AirplaneGeeks.com/384. We are kind of all over social media, so you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher.com, TuneIn Radio. We have our listener team, our new listener team on Slack. If you want to learn about that, AirplaneGeeks.com/team. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
So long.
Keep the blue side up.
That was my Dan Webbage imitation.
Oh, I'm sure he'd be thrilled.
It's just not the same anymore without having Dan to pick on. You know, it just changed everything in the world.
So that,
you know, can I tell you that this whole copyright thing is just absolutely overrated? I mean, who cares if we use a picture? What are the chances that someone's ever going to find Max Flight to take it out on them? I mean, you know, really.
Yeah, no, there was a whole lot of background noise all of a sudden from somewhere.
I don't know. I was just standing here. I wasn't doing nothing. Okay. It wasn't me.